KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm John O'Brien. Welcome to Speakers Forum, a series of talks and interviews with writers, artists, storytellers, and thinkers recorded at events around Seattle. Tonight's episode features readings from the third annual Lit Crawl Seattle, an event inspired by Litquake, San Francisco's literary festival. Seattle's version is a one-night-only mashup of a literary festival and a pub crawl. Over 60 authors do their best to silence you or rile you up as you make your way from space to space. The third annual Lit Crawl Seattle took place on October 23, 2014, at venues around Capitol Hill. Thanks to Michelle Goodman and Anna Tadashev for these recordings. We'll start off with the appearance of Irish phenom novelist Emer McBride at Elliott Bay Book Company. Here she reads the opening from her novel, A Girl is a Half-Formed Thing. Please be advised, the following program contains language of an adult nature.
Hello, Seattle. It's very exciting to be here. And I was just saying before, I never really thought I would be in America reading from my book to anyone, so this is a very lovely experience. I'm going to start with the opening of the book. It's one of my favourite pieces to read, and I think for people who don't know the book, it's maybe a fair way to lure you in to maybe some writing that might be a little bit different to what you're used to. The book is set in Ireland, rural Ireland, sort of across the 80s and the early 90s, and it starts in the womb. For you, you'll give her name. In the stitches off her skin, she'll wear your say. Mammy me, yes you, bounce the bed, I'd say. I'd say that's what you did. Then lay you down, they cut you round, wait and hour and day. Walking up corridors, up the stairs, are you all right? Will you sit? He says. No, I want, she says, I want to see my son. Smell from Dettol through her skin, mops, diamond floor tiles, all as strong. Oh, burn your eyes out if you had some. Her heart going pat, going dum, dum, dum. Don't mind me, she's going to your room. See the Jesus, what have they done? Jesus, bile for titles, burn, shh, all over, mother. She cries, oh no, no, no. I know the thing wrong. It is called nosebleeds, headaches, where you can't hold full mugs and dinner plates. She says, clear up. A young, he says, give the child a break. Fall off swings, can't or grip well, slipping in the muck, bang your poor head wrapped up white and the blood come through. She feel the sick of that, little boy head. Shh. She saw it first when you couldn't open your eye. Don't wink so long, wind will change and you'll stay that way. I'm not, mammy, it's got stuck. She pull it open, hold it up. I can't, it's all fall down. And now, holy family on a Saturday night, he is leaning, you are sleeping, she the chair, me whirl about. Listen in to doctor chat. We done the best we could. There really wasn't much. It's all through his brain, like the roots of trees. Sorry, don't say that. He's running out, I'm afraid he's running down. You should take him home, enjoy him while you can. He's not, he is. Can't you operate again? We can't. Something. Chemo, then. We'll have a go at that. Gethsemane, dear Lord, hear our prayer, our pleas. Intercession. Night in hospital beds. Faces on the candle wick. Lino in the knees. Please don't, God, take our Holy Mary, Mother of all, humbly we beseech thee. You, white-faced, feel the needle go in. Feel fat, juicy, poison, young boy skin. In your arteries, eyeballs, spine, hands, legs. Puke it cells up all day long. No, mammy, don't let them. Weeks for you, weeks it. Scared and bold and wet the bed. Dark trees outside for me when it weather rains. She praying in a coat until I am froze. Hard chapel, kneelers, bare need, real repents. She does. And our father was. Where? Somewhere there, I think. There's good news and bad news. It's shrunk. He's saved. He's not. He'll never be. So like it, lump it, a short breath's what you've got. Jesus, in her blood that minute. Rejoice, sacred heart of Christ. But we'll never be rid. Do you understand? He says. Shh now, she says. Shh. Your pink face make that sitting up the best thing she's ever done. Watching you going, growing hair. Scabby over slices where scalpels were. Don't look. Telling what's the time and where you are. Makes her happy. Makes our father walk down corridors alone. He says, I can't be waiting for it all the time. I'd give my eyes to fix him, but the heart cannot be wrung and wrung. And she, like calmest Virgin Mary, sitting on the bed, hands warming up her sides for, what are you saying? Breath. Going. Leaving. But he's just stopped dying. This one's to come. Please don't. No, I won't stop you. Could never make you do a thing. You'll support us. Aren't you great? Oh, the house is mine. It's for the best. For who? You, me. Board my body up. I'm not for loving anymore. I live for housework, dressing kids, and you for mortgage, new shoes, spuds. Can't live short hope, but gas bills long and paid on time too. Oh, so kind. Aren't you the fine shape of a man? He left her with a £50 note. Take care. Stroke combing full, untidied hair. Thinking I think of you and me. Our empty spaces where father should be. Whenabouts we might find them and what we'd do to fill them up. But didn't time continue still? Where's daddy? Gone. Why's that? Just is. And yelps she at the strength growing to your tips. Poke belly of baby that's kicking is me. Full in myself. Bustling hatchery. And I loved swimming to your touch. Lay on the lining for your strokes, for your secret pressed hellos. Show my red foot. Look, look there. Baby, when you're born, I pick your name. See, you and me were busy with each other long before I came. She was careful of you, saying, let's take it slow. Mind your head, dear heart. And her guts said, thank God. For her gasp of air, for this grant of nurse, I will. Learning you our father's art. And when you slept, I lulled in joyful mysteries, glorious until I kingdom come. Mucus stogging up my nose, screamed to rupture day. Fatty snorting like a creature, a vinegar world I smelled. There now, a girline, isn't she great? Bawling, oh, now you're safe. But I saw less with these flesh eyes, outside, almost without sight. She asking after, and I'm all fine. Hand on my head, her hand on my back, dividing from the sweet of mother flesh that could not take me in again. I curled there, learning limb from limb, curdled under hot lamps, sorrow lapped. I'm so glad your brother's lived, that he'll see you, it'll all be. But something's coming, wiping off my begans, wiping all my every time. I struggle up to, I struggle from, the smell of milk now, going dim, going blank, going white.
Here, Emer McBride was asked if her novel A Girl is a Half-Formed Thing was her first novel, which makes for another fascinating tale.
It is my first novel. And on that note, I should probably tell you a little bit of the backstory, which was I wrote the book in 6 months, in 2003 and 2004, and filled with zeal and self-confidence, I started to send it out, certain that the literary world was about to fall at my feet, and got vast quantities of rejection letters, which said, this is a great book, But we have no idea what to do with it or how to sell it or where it fits in. And we don't think anyone's going to take a chance on it. And we're certainly not going to take a chance on it. So I, after about 5 years of that, I put it in the drawer and started writing my second novel and thought that was kind of it. Because I wasn't willing to rewrite it as something more traditional or accessible, traditionally accessible. And then about 4 years later, after putting it in the drawer, I moved to Norwich in the east of England. And one day my husband was gossiping in the local bookshop with the local bookseller, who asked him what his wife did, and he told him the long, sorry tale of his wife, the great literary failure. And the man behind the counter said, well, that's very interesting, because some friends and I are thinking of setting up a press. Do you think she'd let us read it? And I then followed a couple of months of farce in which my husband told me that he'd said to him I would send it, and to him that I would send it, and there was all sorts of, I don't know. Anyway, one day I was cursing the bookseller, and it came to light that he never got the right message. So I then gave him the book, and he read the book, and he liked it, and he came back, and he said, this is a great book, but we have no money, and we don't know what we're doing, and we're about to publish our first book. Can we come back to you when we have more money and know what we're doing? And I said, oh, fine, thinking I would never hear from them again. And a year later, they came back and they said, we know a little bit more about what we're doing now, but we still don't have any money. But can we publish your book? And I said, go on then. And so then it was published in June 2013. So that was the arduous tale of my march of failure towards publication and to this very spot where I stand now among you. Woo, indeed.
You're listening to Lit Crawl Seattle 2014 on Speakers Forum, KUOW 94.9. Stay tuned for poetry from Floating Bridge Review number 7.
12 minutes past 9, 94.9 KUOW. Tomorrow evening, we're going to hear stories about stepping out of the pace of our daily lives and doing things like, well, peeking inside a microsecond, mastering the fastest thing in the universe, taking a look at the longest-running science experiment in history, and trying to comprehend the speed of high-frequency trading. It's all about speed, high speed and low speed, and everything in between on Radiolab tomorrow evening at 7. Support for KUOW comes from Maria Hines Restaurants, Tilth's New American Cuisine, Golden Beetle's Mediterranean, and Agrodolce's Southern Italian. Inspired artisan cooking, 95% organic, and sourced locally. Menus and reservations at MariaHinesRestaurants.com.
This is Ari Shapiro from NPR News. Did you know that renewing members are KUOW's most reliable source of support? If you recently received your renewal notice in the mail, please mail it back today or renew online at KUOW.org. Thanks.
Weather outlook for the Seattle area for tonight. Lows near 30, partly cloudy. Friday highs lower to mid-40s, sunny skies.
Welcome back to Speakers Forum on KUOW 94.9 Seattle. You're listening to readings from Lit Crawl Seattle 2014. This next segment is introduced by Washington Poet Laureate Elizabeth Austin.
To my left, Tara Hardy, who is the author of Bring Down the Chandeliers, published by Right Bloody Press. She's a former Seattle poet populist, former writer-in-residence at Richard Hugo House, and founder of BENT, a writing institute for LGBT people in Seattle. She has been a maid, uniform included, a park ranger, tractor included, convenience store clerk, drunk and threatening customers included, an activist, self-righteousness included, and a teacher, Apple definitely included. And on my far right, Anise Giselle is a poet, performer, and recovering codependent. She gets better at it every day. For money, she has delivered AV equipment, folded swim towels, house sat, cat sat, dog sat, baby sat, cleaned toilets, case managed, and currently she tutors the greatest students in Seattle. And finally, just to my right is Martha Kreiner. Martha's poetry has appeared in Hubbub and Ilk Journal, and she now works as a registered nurse with Healthcare for the Homeless in Seattle, but formerly took orders at a drive-through window in Wisconsin, stripped beds at a Super 8 motel in Illinois, and scrubbed toilets in Michigan. Yay. All right. And to kick off the poetry tonight, by the way, we're going to be reading poets from the journal who live all over, but you'll also get to hear the poems that our readers tonight wrote as well. So to kick it off, I'm going to ask Tara Hardy to come on up and get us started.
Yay. I clean toilets in Michigan, too. We should talk about toilets in Michigan. So I want to thank Elizabeth Austin for asking me to do this reading and also soliciting a poem for this anthology, since I'm the laziest poet on earth. She really had to pull it out of me. And it's a beautiful anthology, so I'm excited that it's been released. So the first poem that I'm going to read has a prop, and this is it. It will become important towards the end of the poem. It's important to remember. This is the title of the poem. It's called Don't. Okay, just remember that. And this is by Aaron Fristad. Don't. None of us knew who wrote it or remembered when it first appeared. It was part of the landscape, but we looked at it in awe every time we passed under the Fred Zarhoff Bridge. It meant different things depending if you were coming or going from the fishing grounds, if you'd made money or not. On sunny afternoons without rain gear, without our hoods on, when it was warm enough to look up, we pondered out loud, who? And more importantly, did it work? Often, a new guy trying to impress us would say he knew the guy whose girlfriend did it. The other new guy would cut him off. No, man, it was the dude's wife, and he died before he ever saw it. You're both wrong, I'd say. It was a crew member I worked with in the 80s. I remember the night he did it. The crab season ran long that year. We were making money, but all the crab were out west in Dutch, and we only came to town once to pick up more pots. We had 24 hours to see our wives and kids. They made love. Actually, they probably f***ed like starved animals the way we all did our first night back, but then they fell asleep, curled in a ball, and he dreamed of eating bacon with his kids in the morning. The phone woke him. Boat leaves in an hour. There's a front moving in. She went ballistic. He hadn't even seen the kids. She told him if he left, she would too. Head to her sister's in Phoenix. She'd have the divorce papers filed before the season was over. It was snowing hard when I pulled up, and she was chasing him down the front walk, punching his hunched over back with her little pink fists. She was barefoot, her silk robe falling open. I remember thinking, where do you get a robe like that in Kodiak? She threw a garbage can lid at my truck as we pulled away. He was silent, but I could see the tears running down his face in the light from the oncoming cars. He pulled out a flask and took a long pull. I never told him, but when I looked back, his two kids had come outside, the little one trying to catch snowflakes in her mouth. We arrived at the boat and he disappeared. Skipper was anxious to leave. I stalled by saying the main needed an oil change. I heard the guys screaming on deck and thought he'd fallen overboard. I ran topside and realized they were cheering. There he was, hanging from the bridge. He'd lowered himself down using a tie-up line. He had paint we used to mark buoys. This shuts up the new guys. They don't want to know what happened next. They don't want to know if it was true.
This next poem is by Sylvia Pollack, and I picked it to share with you out of this anthology because sometimes you come across a poem that is brave and doesn't back down from the truth, and it's moving in that way. I also picked it for personal reasons, one, because I'm a vegetarian, and two, because my dad just finished his third round of treatment for lung cancer, and somehow this poem makes room for everything there is in the world, and it can get complicated. I believe Sylvia's poem is a great container, so thank you, Sylvia Pollack, for your work and for this poem. It's called Thicket. Through the thicket of ribs, a needle probes the left side of a chest, slips into a chamber. Scarlet pulses into the syringe, slows, stops over and over the same procedure on each of the waiting sisters and brothers. Pooled in a fat 50 milliliter tube, their blood cross-connects in a clot dense and final as a placenta, pulling away from the straw-colored serum. It looks like mead. Sometimes I harvest nearly half a cup if the litter was large. With that, I will do experiments for months, report in a cancer journal. Serum from day-old San Juan rabbits was used as a source of cofactors for these assays. Not having to mention small gray pelts, immobile noses stacked on my laboratory bench.
Hi. My first poem is by Sarah Graybeal, and it's called Bald Eagle Proud. The cleaning company is called Bald Eagle Proud. I meet its owner at a cafe in South Philadelphia, where over Eggs Benedict, his stomach squeezing against his belt, he tells me, "I can speak Spanish, understand it too. I only need help with the nuances." At 10 o'clock that night, he calls with my first message to deliver. Tell Segundo the glass globes were streaked at Budokan. Tell him to clean them twice today, just in case. Dave is right. There are nuances to all this. There are overtones, but I do my best to stick to the script. It is the same with the grease-specked oven, the single chair left unstacked after the party at Granite Hill. In the office, Dave leans into his leather sofa, hands folded diplomatically, discussing his frustrations. I smooth my timesheet, sliced into pairs of minutes, 2 for this text, 4.5 for this call. At $15 an hour, I have just enough gas money to drive home. 1 month later, the silverware at El Rey disappears. "Ask him what happened," says Dave. "Not an accusation, just a question." This is where the nuance comes in. "No es acusación, solo es pregunta," I say, my words falling like stones into silence. "Señora, we don't know what Dave means. We didn't take it." I wonder what he looks like, what he eats in the morning, whether he dreams of returning to a country where the nuances are fewer, or simply more inviting to contemplate. We say goodbye formally this time. Que muy amable. May you be well. Knowing in that way that humans know things without ever being told, we will not be speaking again.
This is a poem by a writer named Caitlin Hibbard, and a number of lines in it are italicized, and I'm going to do my best to italicize my voice. But those italicized lines come from a 1915 Minnesota teacher manual. And this poem overall is based on an incident that was described in a book called Florence by Audrey Wendland. Caitlin Hibbard's Some Rules for Teachers. From her bedroom window, she watches him, the only beekeeper in Lincoln County, tending wooden hives set up on stilts in the apple orchard, careful not to crowd his colony, lest they migrate to a hollow tree in a distant field. "You may not marry during the term of your contract. You are not to keep company with men." Sweetness spills from the cracks of her dreams, the house loud with humming, buzzing, waiting for a letter from her sweetheart in Minot, waiting for her life to begin. Never a woman's work to tend the bees, only to sell honey, the few customers fiercely guarded, sun in a jar to lighten the sting of long winters on the edge of the prairie. You may not dress in bright colors. By day, she teaches the children of hard luck farmers and traveling preachers, their shoes scuffed and worn, dresses made over from their mother's dresses, knickers patched at the knee, some patched at the patches, some eager to learn their numbers and letters, some so far behind from working the fields, sure to become food for powder in the Great War. You must wear at least 2 petticoats. Your dresses must not be any shorter than 2 inches above the ankles. Every year, a new school, forced to board with whoever lives closest. She barely hears the creaks and groans, pays no mind when the parlor wall crinkles in tiny webs. Soon to be a spinster at 27, she dreams of marriage, a house in town, the ache in her arms holding other people's children. You may, under no circumstances, dye your hair. One small crack grows slowly, splits open faded wallpaper roses. The whole wall packed with the industry of bees, waxy combs from floor to ceiling. The children swarm to scoop up what oozes to the wooden floor, their small, chapped hands sticky and glistening.
Stay tuned after this quick break for more readings from Seattle's Lit Crawl 2014. From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm John O'Brien.
932 KUOW 94.9. Many of us like the feeling of getting lost in a good story and seeing the world through a character's eyes in that story. Recently, psychologists have been studying whether or not that experience actually changes readers. Tomorrow night, hear novelist and cognitive psychologist Keith Oatley talk about recent research connecting fiction with empathy. It's all about fiction tomorrow evening at 9. Support for KUOW comes from Best of the Northwest Art and Fine Crafts Show at Seattle's Magnuson Park, Hangar 30, on November 14th, 15th, and 16th to present the second of 2 shows of more than 100 artists with artist demonstrations, food, and kids' activities. Parking available. Information online at northwestartalliance.com. And support for KUOW comes from the UW's Evans School of Public Affairs Master of Public Administration programs, offering degree programs for full-time students and work-compatible options for mid-career professionals. More information at upcoming information sessions and at evans.uw.edu/info. Forecast says lows near 30 tonight for the Seattle area, partly cloudy skies. For Friday, highs lower to mid-40s, sunny skies. Looking ahead to Friday night, lows again near 30, mostly clear. Saturday highs again, lower to mid-40s, and again, sunny skies. Singer, songwriter, and actor Eric Benet has had multiple Grammy and Image Award nominations. Hear Eric Benet in a set of originals and in classics by Stevie Wonder, Earth, Wind, and Fire, and David Foster, beginning in a few minutes at 10 o'clock.
You're listening to Speakers Forum on KUOW 94.9 Seattle. Next up in our Seattle Lit Crawl tag-along, we have readings from the 7 at 7 Hugo House event.
We have a treat in store. Next, we have Donna Mascolta, whose first novel was When the De La Cruz Family Danced, which was published in June 2011. Her story collection, Natalie Wood's Fake Puerto Rican Accent, was a finalist for the 2010 Grace Paley Prize for Short Fiction. Her work has appeared in many journals and reviews, and she has received numerous grants, awards, and residencies. She's an ardent supporter and contributor to Seattle's literary community, and we are so delighted to have her here tonight. So please join me in welcoming Donna Mascolta.
Thank you, Jenny. Can you hear me? Okay. This is a short excerpt from a novel I'm working on called The Education of Angie Rubio. Angie sprinted, slowed, veered left, then right, doubled back, the dust flying in her face, a pebble pinging off her glasses. After days of standing on the sidelines, she had joined the group, the small mob of 6th grade girls in pursuit of Miles Jones. The Boy with the English Accent. How someone from Liverpool could find his way to Kimball Park was a miracle. One in a million, and no one should take it lightly. Certainly not this gang of girls, some of whom were already plotting to sneak Miles, a mere fourth grader, into the sixth grade dance on Saturday. Though now she was part of the mindless with Beatlemania chase, she refused to scream or swoon at the sight of Miles's floppy brown hair or the sound of his Paul McCartney lilt, despite Jory Page Schroeder. Jory Page Schroeder was the biggest screaming swooner of the pack. Her name was really Debbie, but she had somehow managed to get everyone to call her Jory Page. A name she had jigsawed together from the first two letters of the name of each of the Beatles. Jory Page Schroeder made Angie feel small, not just because she was small and skinny to boot, but because Jory Page used words as if they were baseball bats. Just yesterday in the girls' lavatory, Angie emerged from a stall, only to be confronted by Jory Page's blue eyes boring down on her. "Don't you like the Beatles?" "Yes, I love the Beatles." Angie had recently learned to gush by listening to Judy Wykamp and Sylvia Rico and the other girls who panted their words. Angie gave it another try. "I adore the Beatles." "Then why aren't you chasing after Miles like the rest of us?" Angie thought it best not to point out that Miles was not a Beatle. "I have asthma or something," she lied. Her cousin Eddie was afflicted with all sorts of maladies, and Angie often borrowed one when it was convenient. "I would sacrifice my life for something I believed in," Jory Page said, narrowing her blue eyes at Angie before flouncing past her into the stall and slamming shut the door. "But I think it might be under control soon, the asthma," Angie called through the door. "I have some medicine at home. I'll be fine tomorrow," she promised over the flush of the toilet. Now tomorrow was today, and she was in the chase, so she ran. And though a stitch in her side distorted her gait, and one of her shoelaces had worked itself loose, she kept on running, until she realized she was running alone. There was just too much clutter with dodgeball and kickball games going on around her, and kids running in and out of the sandbox that held the monkey bars. She had lost the hunt, and now trotted back and forth, trying to locate the others. When she stopped a moment to get her bearings, a stray ball bounced into her back, making her stumble and dislodging her glasses. She was adjusting them when she heard Jory Page shout her name. Though she had her glasses on straight now, her vision was impaired by the cloud of dust kicked up by Miles as he shot past her, followed soon by the panting posse. Jory Page skidded to a stop in front of her, a scowl of incomprehension inflaming her face. "How could you just stand there and do nothing?" Then she was off, her rebuke trailing into a Beatlemania's scream as she rejoined the chase. The stitch in Angie's side seemed to have moved to her throat. She swallowed hard and stooped to retie the wayward shoelace. She would get back in Jory Page's good graces, she vowed to herself. There was still lunch recess. Yesterday after school, Jory Page had reminded the posse that they were all to know the words to help. So Angie had gone home and played Help on the record player over and over, closing her eyes, moving her lips to the words, fixing them in her head. But then Eva walked in. She was in junior high and wore a bra and black flats with nylon stockings and a touch of lipstick, all of which made her seem an imposter. As she sang along to Help, Angie watched Eva take off her shoes and stockings and lipstick, watched her unmask herself, hoping to see the old Eva appear. "What are you staring at?" Eva snapped. Angie moved her gaze to the ceiling and kept singing. Eva turned off the record player. "When did you get so mean?" Angie asked. But she knew the answer, knew that it was the junior high costume, its poor fit, the feeling of being trapped in those stockings. Deprived of the record player, Angie talked the words to the song. "When I was younger, so much younger than today, I never needed anybody's help in any way." "Shut up, Angie," Eva said. But now these days are gone. I'm not so self-assured. The words drove Eva from the room, and Angie sat alone to learn them by heart. Angie was good at memorizing, and now she was consoled by the prospect of redeeming herself with the posse at lunch recess. Having tied her shoe, she stood and looked around. If she stood where she was, she might blend into one of the games around here, appear to be an outfielder for kickball, or part of the ragged dodgeball circle. She stood there thinking, shouldn't the bell have rung by now? She squinted upward as if the answer was there in the sky, cloudless and blue, the sun beaming genially as if all life were fun and games. Just when orange spots were beginning to zip across her glasses, she heard the frantic shouts of her name, the command issuing from Jory Page and Judy Wycamp and Sylvia Rico and the others, grab him, Angie. She looked up and saw Miles running her way, his John Lennon hair flapping. A breeze filled his shirt so that its ballooning fabric offered a handhold, but when she reached for it, the airy shirt fluttered from her grasp. She made one last heroic lunge and was rewarded with a fistful of sleeve, which she clutched triumphantly. Miles, slight fourth grader that he was, still outmuscled her, and as he tried to continue his momentum, he pulled Angie after him. She staggered, fought for balance, finally gained both feet again, when he suddenly twisted sideways, away from the unyielding grip she had on his sleeve, and the rip that followed seemed to slice through all the noise of the playground, seemed to bring all the games to a halt. She was sure that everyone witnessed Miles staring at her, at the gap in his shirt, at the shred of fabric in her hand. He gaped in horror, as if she'd torn off his arm rather than his sleeve. She stared back, unable to speak. And then he ran off in tears to the teacher on playground duty. It was then that she understood that despite all shouts of catch Miles, it was never the intention that anyone really catch him, much less touch him, much less tear the sleeve off his shirt. It was all about the chase, only the chase. Jory Page, glassy-eyed and open-mouthed, sleepwalked toward her. Angie held the sleeve helplessly in front of her, and she could see in Jory Page's crushed expression, now that the chase was over forever, how much she wanted to grab the sleeve in Angie's hand, but couldn't, because even screaming, swooning Jory Page Schroeder knew better, knew the rules of the game. Thanks.
Fun, huh? Next up, we have Frances McHugh, who is no stranger to Hugo House. She's the founder of Hugo House, and she served 10 years as its director and is an award-winning author and poet. Her latest book is called Mary Randlett Portraits. Yeah? Did I get it right?
Yeah.
I can't see a thing over there. Her book of poetry, Bled, won the 2011 Washington State Book Award. She was also a finalist in the nonfiction category that year with a book titled The Car That Brought You Here Still Runs, Revisiting the Northwest Towns of Richard Hugo. And as many of you know, she's a generous spirit in the Seattle community and a very fun gal. Please welcome Frances McHugh.
Thanks, everybody. So this Mary Randlett Portraits book is... Well, it's a little bit of Seattle history, and it includes visual artists and writers to accompany portraits taken by the photographer Mary Randlett. One of the people whom she photographed quite a bit was Tom Robbins. You all know who Tom Robbins? Still Life with a Woodpecker, Even Cowgirls Get the Blues. And this is a little piece I wrote about having to chaperone Tom Robbins. And it's coming out in the new Sasquatch anthology edited by Ryan Boudinot about literary places in Seattle. Chaperoning Tom Robbins. My job was to meet Tom Robbins in the alley behind Tower Records along University Way in Seattle. This was in 1987, or maybe it was early in 1988. Why the alley? I asked. Why not the lobby of the bookstore across the street or something? That's what he wants, Colleen McElroy said. She looked fiercely at me. Back then, the MFA program at the University of Washington was newly formed. It used to be an MA degree, and Colleen had been the one to get the F inserted in it. And Colleen was a well-known poet and the program's director, and she was just nobody to mess with. She was also the faculty advisor for this reading series, and I was a young student, and we Watermark people, the Watermark reading series, had decided to invite Tom Robbins to give a reading on campus. So I bring him over there from Tower Records to Kane Hall. Colleen looked at me. Yes, and you be sure he isn't late. She lowered her eyebrows. Colleen bossed me around. Partly because I was the youngest person in the MFA program, I had a skateboard and I went around twirling the wheels all the time. And partly because I have an instinct to both rebel and attach, I took to her. I was a girl with a mouth and some smarts, and what smarts I didn't have, I used my mouth to make up for. I was pretty ambitious. I wanted to get this whole literary business right. Later, I figured out that Colleen had some of the same traits. She'd been an only child from her mother's first failed marriage, and she'd also been a bookish, mouthy kid who got out of the place where she began and headed west. So, on the appointed night, I walked over to 43rd, one of the side streets off of University Way. I headed up behind the Big Tower Records. Big Five Sports is there now. The alley was filthier then, crowded with dumpsters and metal trash cans. It was early evening and the day's refuse had steamed and settled. The place stunk. I came along the trench, a broken pavement, and when I looked up, I saw a little man between two big guys. They all looked down the alley at me. That's the first thing about Tom Robbins. He's smaller than you think he's going to be. He has this impish, crooked grin and some prickly blonde hair, and he's light and small, but the other guys weren't. They were big, thick guys. Hey, Tom said. Hi, I said. This is Bob, Tom said. He pointed to the man who had a little beard scruff. And this is Bob, he said, pointing to the other one. Hi. I was staring at the three of them. Tom in the middle, with these guys bookending him. I nodded to the two men. You guys are both named Bob? Yes, they are, said Tom Robbins. I'm Tom, and these are Bob's. Oh, hi. I reached out and shook Tom's hand. The Bobs flinched a little. One leaned in over our handshake. These are my bodyguards, Tom said, flicking his thumbs in either direction. Remember the thumbs in the... Okay. The Bobs had bulges on the chests of their overcoats. Guns? Do they have guns? Of course they have guns, Tom Robbins said. Listen, I was down at Berkeley and some woman threw a bottle at me right out of the audience. It was crazy. Maybe it was jitterbug perfume or even cowgirls get the blues that had ticked them off. Whatever it was, things didn't go over that well at Berkeley. This was confusing for me. Tom Robbins, the radical novelist whom the radical feminists didn't like. Back then, I thought radical was radical. I didn't know that different parts of radical might not like each other. Okay, I said, well, what did I know? I had a lot to learn. I was maybe 24 years old, and I didn't have the slightest idea about how cool Tom Robbins was, or how famous, or what was necessary for a writer of that stature. Bodyguards? Okay, then. I walked with Tom and his Bobs over to the Rethke, the Rethke Auditorium at Kane Hall. Amazing. I think of it now, how many world-class writers have read in that space. Adrienne Rich, Elizabeth Bishop, Nobel laureates, you name it. It's one of Seattle's long-lasting literary crossroads, and it's right on Red Square in a bunker-like structure next to the Exhale Tower from the parking garage. I once watched Raymond Carver and Tess Gallagher make their way up the aisles in that space, Tess flicking back her hair and Ray in a long overcoat, looking for a seat for some reading I can't remember. When Tom and the Bobs came into Kane Hall, we went to the room behind the auditorium. I said, so I saved some seats for Bob and Bob. No, Tom said. Bob and Bob will be on stage with me. But I have seats for them right in the front row. Tom turned to me and snapped. How the f*** will they shoot anybody if they're sitting in the f*** front row? I didn't have an answer. This was before Public Enemy taught us all about having an aggressive presence on stage. Oh, wow. I said, oh. I think I went to Colleen and told her what was going on, and I can't remember whether she asked the Bobs to take a seat or what, but the audience was full. Tom read his wild work, and people cheered, and nobody threw a bottle, and the Bobs didn't have to open fire. Nobody got hurt. Afterwards, we went to China Harbor, that big black glassed-in, impossible-to-see-inside restaurant on Lake Union where I sat next to Tom's wife, Alexa, who turned out to be an astrologer. When I met her, I realized people can really be astrologers. The world then seems so full of possibility. Thank you.
And you always wondered what it was like to hang out with Tom Robbins, right? Finally, and not least at all, number seven is Mr. Jamie Ford, who came all the way from Montana to be with us tonight. Jamie, as you no doubt know, won the highly acclaimed and best-selling, highly acclaimed and best-selling novel Hotel at the Corner of Bitter and Sweet. His latest book is The Songs of Willow Frost. He's also published in Secret Identities, the Asian American Superhero Anthology, and The End is Nigh, part of the Apocalypse Triptych, a series of three anthologies of apocalyptic and post-apocalyptic fiction. He likes the post-apocalypse, I guess. But perhaps his biggest accomplishment is being the father of four freaking teenagers, even though he looks like he's about 28. Our grand finale tonight, Mr. Jamie Ford.
Wow. I love this dark room. This is like a basement warren where we plot a Bolshevik revolution. Vote Strelnikov. That's for you Dr. Zhivago fans. Okay. I'm going to read just three pages, since we're close to Halloween, three pages of a ghost story that I wrote just last week for Humanities Washington. And if you like it, it's out there on the interwebs. And it's a true ghost story, which is interesting. I know it's true because my Ouija board told me it was true. So... This is Wish You Were Here at the Bottom of a Well. December 1911. F. Lewis Clark had been married to his beautiful wife, Winifred, a Parisian-schooled socialite and concert pianist of some renown, for 18 years, and in that time, she'd never once been faithful. You see, Winifred was an artist whose favorable medium was infidelity, whose canvases were the finest sateen sheets as she dabbled in exotic oils and silk and sweat. Though to be somewhat fair, F. Lewis was no perfect man either, no candidate for sainthood. By 1911, he was a Maine-born, Harvard-schooled multimillionaire amassing a vast fortune in timber, mining, and real estate. And he'd had his own moments of weakness, but to his credit, he'd never purposely gone out of his way to hurt anyone, not the way Winifred did when she looked at him knowingly and blew him a kiss before taking the arm of Horace Ketchum, F. Lewis's longtime business partner and the best man at his wedding. She smiled as she led him upstairs to one of the many guest bedrooms of the Spokane Club. F. Lewis had long known of the affair, but he knew with a clarity now that pierced his heart. He watched them brazenly ascend the staircase, his world frozen. He was a prisoner with a noose around his neck, standing on the gallows, waiting for the trapdoor. He was the child whose kitten had gone missing near the railroad tracks. He was the expectant mother watching a doctor fumble with a stethoscope, knowing the next words will be, "There is no heartbeat." And so it was with a broken heart that F. Lewis invited his wife to the basement of the Spokane Club the next evening. "I want you to see the wine cellar," he said. "I need your help picking out a bottle, something special I can celebrate with." "You can't do anything by yourself, can you, Lewis?" she groaned. "What's the occasion? Horace says business is failing your half anyways." "It's a special celebration," he mumbled as he led her through the dusty cellar and beyond a small creaking door into a dark room that had been locked for as long as F. Lewis could remember. "You won't believe what's in here." "Really?" Winifred said, yawning. She'd been up quite late the night before. And what are we celebrating, dear husband? F. Lewis waited a moment until her eyes could adjust to the darkness, until he knew she could see what his eyes were searching for, a deep pit in the middle of the room. But F. Lewis knew that the real pit, the true yawning abyss, had been found in his own chest when he had walked into the master suite of Honeysuckle Lodge, his palatial estate on Hayden Lake. His arms had been filled with red roses, but Winifred was also in bloom, and her arms were filled with Horace, as he made love to her atop the grand piano F. Lewis had given her for her first wedding anniversary. The Steinway was sturdy, and the piano didn't wobble or budge as Winifred's feet and Horace's knees banged out random notes, rhythmic flats and sharps, while a metronome ticked back and forth like a wagging finger. "Lewis," Winifred needled, "I asked you a question." F. Lewis turned to his wife in the darkness, held her arms gently, touched her lips to his, even as she turned away. And then he whispered, "I'm celebrating our divorce." He didn't push Winifred as much as he let her go, at least that's what he told himself, as he watched her corseted body tip backward, bending, falling slowly like a freshly hewn Douglas fir. He studied her shocked, wide-eyed expression as she tumbled, her dress, scarlet lace, and white petticoats swallowed whole by the darkness. F. Lewis licked his lips, tasting her final, reluctant kiss as he wiped a single tear. He winced as her screams were interrupted, as she bounced against the walls of the old well he'd kept hidden in the basement of the gentleman's club that he helped build. F. Lewis closed his eyes, and his heart raced as he listened in vain for a splash or a crash, but her body trailed off seemingly to infinity. Without an impact, she wasn't dead in his mind. She was merely gone, because no one knew how deep this ancient well was. Before construction on the club began, engineers, oilmen experienced in drilling 2,000-foot boreholes had given up when their means of measurement played out at 6,000 feet. And no one knew who did the masonry or when, but superstitious locals had boarded up the hole ages ago and marked it with a sign that read Porta Infernus. F. Lewis nodded and sighed. He didn't believe in the gates of hell. He'd been married to Winifred for 18 years. The rest of the story is out there, and I think it's for sale, and the proceeds all go to Humanities Washington. And Humanities Washington, they promote literacy and cure erectile dysfunction. They do all kinds of crazy things. So thank you.
Thanks, everybody. Let's have a hand for all of our wonderful writers. Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to Lit Crawl Seattle 2014 on Speakers Forum, KUOW 94.9. We're podcasting prose and poetry versions of Lit Crawl 2014 on our website, kuow.org/speakersforum. If you appreciate the series, please leave a good review. It helps us find more. It helps more people find us. Lit Crawl Seattle is a volunteer organization. Readers, hosts, venues, and sponsors donate time, goods, and services to make it possible. This year's sponsors include the Elliott Bay Book Company, Georgetown Brewing Company, Hugo House, Shunpike, For Culture, and DCG1. The third annual Lit Crawl Seattle took place on October 23, 2014, at venues around Capitol Hill. Many thanks to Michelle Goodman and Anna Tatashev for these recordings. For Speakers Forum, KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm John O'Brien.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at kuow.org.